Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We've got good news. The world is open again, and people like you, people of faith, are traveling to Catholic sites around the world. Want to travel with exceptional Catholic leaders this fall, next year, or in the future? Are you looking to see specific sites, celebrate traditional Latin Mass, or travel to destinations without vaccine requirements? We are here to help you deepen your faith on pilgrimage. Give us a call at 1-800-842-4842 or visit us online at selectinternationaltours.com. Select International Tours is your pilgrimage company, and we have the perfect Catholic trip for you.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Welcome back to The Shepherd's Pie, a slice of faith for our messy lives. I'm Tony Kolenk, a professor at Ave Maria School of Law, the father of five grown children, and also the author of inspirational fiction for both teens and adults. I am excited about my new release that came out from our Sunday visitor just in time for Lent, Penny and the Stolen Chalice. So it's a modern day mystery that takes place in a Catholic school. Penny and her friend have to try to discover who stole the chalice from the church altar. So if you haven't already got a copy of that for your middle grade boy or girl in your life, definitely check it out on my website, antonykolenk.com. But today we're speaking with Dr. David Carrion about overcoming depression through faith-based principles and practices to help us find greater contentment and joy in our lives, no matter what messiness life throws our way. My guest today is Dr. David Carrion. He's a psychiatrist and the co-founder of Acacia Mental Health, which is a clinic in Silicon Valley working to transform mental health care. He's also the author of the book, The Opposite of Depression, What My Work with Suicidal Patients Has Taught Me About Life, Hope, and How to Flourish. He studied and served at Stanford, where he earned his MD, completed a psychiatry residency, and also worked as a professor. He's a leading clinician in the treatment of major depressive disorder and has achieved success in some of the most challenging cases using an approach that combines the latest technologies and the oldest truths. He and his wife, Abigail, live in California. Dr. Carrion, welcome to The Shepherd's Pie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've got quite a background here, but maybe just give us a little bit more on your background and how you got interested in this particular topic.
Well, for a long time, I've been trying to follow the Great Commandment, and I've been trying to love my neighbor as myself and really wanting to know how can I best do that. And when I was a young man, 17 or so, I really thought that was going into to medicine. Originally wanted to be a medical missionary, and so started down the path of trying to become a doctor. When I was in medical school, I took a leave of absence and spent a year in Kenya working for a nonprofit that focused on alleviating extreme poverty. And while I was in Kenya, I realized a couple things. Number one, that sort of unfortunately, my view of the world was a bit naive regarding just how much Kenya needed missionaries, and everybody went to church. They were far more Christian than we were, and so they didn't quite need missionaries per se, but also how influential the West was. The places I came from were undercutting the faith of the people that I went to serve. And that made me realize, well, there's a lot of work that we need to do back where these influences come. And so I decided I was going to go back to Stanford, back to the United States, and really focus on that. And but that also sent me kind of searching for a new job. I thought I was going to be needing to learn about, you know, malaria and tropical diseases and things like that. And so as I started to think about it, I realized I love talking. I love philosophy. I love deep conversation. There is a job where that's actually part of your paid work. And so psychiatry really started to appeal to me from that perspective. But also, where could a Christian worldview make the biggest difference? An atheist cardiologist and a Christian cardiologist both pretty well agree that a heart is a pump and that it should keep pumping so long as you're alive. But for a psyche, what exactly is it? How do we iatros or doctor it? And that might be a place where my perspective and a Christian perspective might make a difference. And so I started to explore it. I did some work in neuroscience with a really great mentor, learned from some really cool psychotherapists, and really, really took to it. So that got me started in psychiatry. But as it went, I started to discover that there is what I've called before the best kept secret in psychiatry is transcranial magnetic stimulation, this non-invasive magnetic thing that's not a drug that you can stimulate the brain. And just as I was getting into it, some of the most incredible breakthroughs in the entire history of psychiatry happened as I started to get into TMS. And so we started to be able to deploy this new technology and see some of these just absolutely miraculous recoveries with this new technology. But then also it raises the question, when you get these people better who have been depressed for 30 years or 50 years, the biological depression is gone, but they don't have any meaningful activities. They don't have a deep relationships. They don't have a profound connection with God. Everything, the depression kind of pretty well taken everything away. But what do you do once you no longer have the biological part? And it became very stark. And especially some of these treatments are 5 days long. And by Friday, sometimes people are better after many, many years of illness. And it really raised the question of, okay, what exactly is it? Does it mean to flourish? And, you know, we sort of say these things are holistic and everything has an influence, but it's very stark when you can like yank the biological away and say, okay, what else is there to a life affected by depression? And how do we rebuild? And how do we help somebody rebuild? That's been a bit of my journey and a bit of the background to, you know, seeing that happen and trying to help people in that journey has helped me think about the nature of depression and what kinds of things help us to not only be undepressed, but flourish.
Now, I have unfortunately, a lot of family members who have sought the care of psychiatrists over the years. And I guess from our experiences, a lot of times psychiatrists are dealing in medication mostly, and the counseling aspects seem to get done by some other social worker or somebody. But what you're describing here sounds a little bit different. And maybe just giving us a real quick overview. What is this procedure that you're talking about, which doesn't involve medication? How does that cure depression? And why have I not heard about this prior to talking to you today?
That last question is one of the most intriguing mysteries of the modern world. I mean, as far as I know, in all of medicine, there is nothing that has such a gap between how many high quality clinical trials have been done and who's heard about it. Like almost everything else, you know, you get a decent trial and like it's all over the place. But I think a big part of it is it gets to systems. The treatments don't exist in a vacuum and technologies don't exist in a vacuum. And part of it is culture. We have been used to, you know, writing prescriptions and giving pills out for 50 years. And so to turn that ship around is going to take some time. So all I'd say, there's all sorts of reasons why people haven't heard about it, but what is it? TMS is a non-invasive electromagnet. The face of the magnet is about the size of a big cell phone. You could put it against your head. The traditional way to do it is you sort of find the middle of the front of the head and you turn it on and it clicks or zaps the spot, activating about a centimeter of your more half an inch brain without having to do anything with drills, and it's great. It's and so you're able to, you know, if you do it over the part of your brain that controls your hand, you get a little twitch in your thumb. You do it over the part of your brain that does speech, you kind of get a little bit of speech delay. It really is a pretty close connection between the zap and what happens in the brain. Now you do it over the part of the brain that is supposed to be the prefrontal cortex, that's supposed to be the top-down control, the rational thought center, and you can activate that part of the brain. And with how we use it, we do a brain scan in advance, an fMRI. We look at the blood flow patterns for, you know, 20 minutes of the ups and downs of the blood flow. And then we use that to guide the treatment. And then we've got some equipment to help navigate the coil to where it needs to be. But all that to say, you turn the rational thought part of the brain up. It turns the emotional, sad, everything is impossible side of the brain down, and adjusts the balance of the circuits. And the traditional way of doing it is actually covered by insurance. 36 sessions over something like 6 or 9 weeks. The accelerated version is 5 days of long days. So we've got a lot of people that fly into our California clinic, get the treatment, and fly back home better, which is extremely exciting.
Is this also being used to treat bipolar disorder by any chance?
There's not many good clinical trials on bipolar. Clinically, I've treated quite a few people with bipolar. It seems to work quite well. The really good evidence on obsessive compulsive disorder, really good evidence on smoking cessation, probably another dozen conditions where there's good evidence. Everything from chronic pain to Alzheimer's are things that this technology might address, but insurance doesn't like to pay for it. So there's a major lack of access or lack of ability to get this covered. And it's not inexpensive. It's a really exciting field for me, who is interested in the business aspect of how do you make this a functional clinic, to how do you get an insurance company to be persuaded to pay for it, to the psychological, spiritual aspect of how do you make this not just be a reductionistic enterprise, as you said, you know, many psychiatrists are. They do it partly because that's what they believe. There's a lot of materialism and physicalism. A lot of psychiatrists don't believe in God or don't believe in there being anything beyond the material. It makes sense that, of course, a pill would be the thing you'd give. But on the other hand, it's like, well, you know, the insurance companies and the people, the powers that be in business side have, you know, kind of forced it. Like, here's your 15 minutes, do what you can. It's like, well, can't really get that deep in 15 minutes. Well, you know, I can adjust this, and that's got a, you know, non-zero probability of making it better. So, I mean, that's at least some good. So, you know, I've got some sympathy for the situation that we kind of got ourselves into this, but there's some sympathy that I have when you don't have any other tools. This is all you've got. And I guess for many people that haven't experienced it, these psychiatrists are working with just people who are in a very, very difficult spot. And so trying stuff that is hard, bad side effects, but it's because the people often are in a very difficult spot.
All right, so let's pivot to the premise of your book, that the opposite of depression. So what is the premise then that you've built into this book? It doesn't sound like the book is about this particular procedure, but more of principles and practices people can use when their chemical depression is not hindering them anymore.
So the premise is that there are a lot of things in a lot of domains that are helpful, and that it really is this sort of interesting nature of the human being. There is an aspect of us which is spiritual, and spiritual things can influence physical, and physical things can influence spiritual things. If you're praying, that's going to affect your experience of pain, of fear, of anxiety. In a sense, for the person that the discovery that I made, or the discoveries that I made in the course of treating people, came through the use of this technology. But the application is for anybody, that you can approach it from any one of numerous angles, numerous perspectives. And sometimes if you're not making progress in one, you can try another. And that I think one of the principles also in wrestling with depression, or if it's not quite fully depression, weariness. I think that there's this sense of weariness that we all have in the modern world that is greater than perhaps it used to be. And, you know, how do you fight against that sort of subclinical, you don't need a doctor kind of level of heaviness? Well, you can approach it from the purely physical, the good advice of, you know, exercise and high quality sleep. I mean, sleep is a remarkable one of like how poorly we sleep. And, you know, because, you know, these, you know, stupid rectangles we carry around in our pockets, cell phones are just incredibly, you know, we just scroll a little bit. I'm just going to look at the news. I mean, no, it's like, it's terrible. It's terrible for us. And we just get so, you know, lose 30 minutes here, hour there. And like, that has a huge influence on the livability of life. But nonetheless, there's, you know, so if working on that, but then also thinking about your thoughts, what's sometimes called metacognition, but also what, you know, Jesus talks a lot about, of you have heard it said behavior, but I say unto you, thought or state of heart. And like, okay, those things are going to affect how you experience the world. You say false things about yourself again and again and again, you're going to feel bad. you make accusations, or if you let yourself or other entities accuse you and you don't respond to them with truth, it's going to affect you. And so too with the spiritual, a strong connection to a faith community, to church or to mass or to the grand narrative, the story that as Christians we're a part of. That is, even if you don't feel like your life is meaningful, well, you're a part of the church and the church surely has meaning. And so if you're able to connect to that and remind yourself of that every Sunday, say, that's another way that you can fight against this darkness if you're in this in-between space.
Are there any of the principles that you're discovering here or rediscovering perhaps that you find are the most useful with the folks you're working with?
It's hard to say. It's a really sort of personalized thing. And I think that maybe the general insight is the really being willing to trial and error. You know, for some people, I say, hey, let's try to do just a little bit of exercise. You know, before you weren't moving, you were just literally in bed all day. Now I want you to try to walk to the mailbox. And that's it. That was it. Because now they've moved a little bit. Now they can move a little bit more. And then, you know, and amazing. And there's a recovery with this suggestion to physically exercise. For other people, it's like, that didn't work at all. Now, I think that what we often will do is that, well, you got to try harder. It's like, yeah, okay, fine. And some maybe, but like, let's just try something else. Let's try to work on your thoughts or maybe go back to confession, or, you know, maybe you should have a conversation with, work on a social connection. You know, there's that friend that's been texting you, maybe text them back. So trying to figure out what the weak points in the depression are in the severe cases. But the good news for most people that are in this sort of weary, languishing, not quite depressed state is that most of those things will work. Almost anything is going to work. Just do something and keep at it. And if you run into a wall, you've got the option of persisting or trying some other good action that's going to help you get better. So I think that the thing that's most, especially in these difficult cases, is not being too attached to one approach. Because of the diversity of aspects of the human soul or the human person, there's many different avenues for improving mental health, improving well-being, improving flourishing.
All right. So you talked about exercise, getting good sleep, and you've mentioned a few times this idea of in your thoughts. I think you maybe even called it metacognition at one point. So maybe can you address that? Like, what would be a very practical, somebody who's struggling a little bit and you're like, hey, let me work on your thoughts. What kind of advice do you give in the book on that?
Working on thoughts is, from at least in the modern psychiatric world, from the cognitive behavioral approach, the cognitive approach. The principle is getting the thoughts that are cycling in your head out of your head in some way. And so in the book, there's suggestions of writing it down. There's sort of structured ways that you can write down what your thoughts are and then have a conversation. Conversations are great. And you can have a conversation with yourself via writing. And there's sort of sometimes structured worksheets. So my mentor's book, Feeling Good, is entirely about this. There's also Feeling Great, the sequel to Feeling Good. And then You Are Not Your Brain by Jeff Schwartz, another one of my mentors. There's these books that really focus on that particular aspect entirely. But the short version is taking the thought, identifying that that is a distorted brain message, that's not me, that's my brain. And then you're able to say, okay, what is the truth? You're totally worthless. Okay, well, I'm not totally worthless. I am a son of God. I'm a child of God. I'm redeemed. Or if you're on the secular side, I'm not totally worthless. I've been able to accomplish such and so with my life. And maybe it's not all I wanted, but it's something. It's not totally worthless. And so you could sort of start to respond to that. And so you could write it down, but you could also have a conversation with a trusted other person. And so doing this with someone who has your best interest in mind. And on that note, the idea of one other, if you're secular, mental construct, if you're a Christian person, is the wise advocate. Imagine somebody that loves you, that cares about you, that has your best interest in mind, and that also is all-knowing. Just imagine someone like that and then ask them, what do you think of this thought? Like, what would they say about this thought? That person's not going to say, I'm totally worthless. They're going to say, that's false. That's not something that this person would say and would even approve of me saying to myself. But thinking about it in that frame is literally a different part of the brain in terms of how you process the information. And so we might be used to using the self-accusational part, but we need to be a little more analytical, move out to the more analytical side when you're doing this particular kind of exercise.
That's really neat. So I hear you saying things like, if I'm having severe negative thoughts, self-negative doubts or something, bring that to Jesus essentially and ask myself, well, what would Jesus say to me? I'm sitting here with him and I'm going to tell him what I think about myself. How would he respond? And I suppose if your view of God and Jesus is a well-formed view, I can imagine some of the things Jesus might say back to you. But let's talk about faith then. Like you mentioned going to church or mass, even connecting with the sacraments, maybe confession. How does that kind of from a psychology or psychiatry point of view work into somebody overcoming depressive thoughts?
Something you'll notice I've been doing is switching between, well, if you're this, then if you're secular, then it's this. If you're Christian, it's that. So, I don't have to necessarily declare to my patients or to your audience, in my role as psychiatrist, I don't have to declare what the truth is. But if the truth is this, then it would be this than otherwise. So in the situation that we're talking about here, from a secular standpoint, I've got a lot of theist colleagues that just love it when people go back to church because it's socialization, it's a behavioral activation, getting out of the house. You've got some aspects of improving metacognition. Jesus tells you to think about your thoughts. So like you've got all these things that are happening, but if from one perspective, it's like, well, that's really interesting from like a cultural, socio-cultural perspective or whatever. Like church does a lot of things that a psychiatrist would want a patient to do, which is be around other people, have deep connections with them, have meaningful conversations, do things that are beyond yourself, have some sense of purpose or meaning. It's like, you got all that now. And that's apart from the possibility that there is, we tend not to talk about doctrine much in psychiatry, but I've been thinking a lot about that more recently. The beliefs that we have matter a lot. And further, there may also be a supernatural aspect to the psychological healing. Now, that may or may not be the case, because it's entirely possible that the healing that's happening is in the spirit, that the supernatural aspect of communion, say, doesn't necessarily need to heal the physical body so much as save your soul. That's the more important thing that the belief in and trust in Christ is doing. But Jesus healed physical ailments as he did psychological or as he did spiritual. And so, of course there's a dual aspect here, but all that to say, to circle back to the beliefs, there's a study done by a guy named Tyler Vanderweel at Harvard, absolutely remarkable study on the impact of frequency of church attendance on suicide completion. Now, it's very difficult to do these kinds of studies. Like, it's not thinking about suicide, it's not attempting suicide, because those are proxy measures. Maybe some people, the real proof in the pudding is, did this really reduce deaths? And so he looked at a study retrospectively called the Nurses Health Study, and there's just a massive data set, but nobody analyzed the religious service variable. Turns out, when you look at that, religious service attendance is, as far as I'm aware, the largest modifiable risk factor for suicide, that you have a fivefold reduction in suicide completion comparing people who frequently attend to people who never attend. Not about doctrine, not about belief, not about anything. If your butt is in a pew on Sunday morning somewhere, you have a drastically lower chance of completing suicide. The Catholics in the sample had a 50-fold reduction in suicide completion. So an absolutely astonishing number, but it seemed extremely protective against all of these other things. And it's not the socialization that really didn't make all that much impact in this particular sample. It's not all these other things. It really does seem to be something going on with regular religious participation. So all that to say, should atheists go to church? Suppose that's a separate conversation. But certainly for those who are, it does seem like it's a dose effect too. But for those who have a background who aren't as engaged, this seems to have a huge impact on at least this aspect of mental health. And suicide, interestingly, tends to break out from a lot of other conditions. So the pills we prescribe tend to help 8 out of 9 depressive symptoms, but don't usually do much for suicide. So the 9th symptom in depression is suicidality, but the pills only help 8. And that's odd. That's an interesting thing. All that to say, those are some of the aspects of how faith can affect mental health.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. And I guess, I mean, in some sense, it shouldn't be a surprising statistic that you just gave us, because I suppose suicide is kind of the ultimate symptom of despair. And if you have some sort of faith that you're regularly exposed to, it would seem that there'd be some level of hope that would at least defeat the ultimate despair. So it makes sense to me in my non-psychiatrist brain. So, all right, if folks are wondering, well, hey, should I get this guy's book? What's in this book that is going to really help me? What would be your best pitch as to, you know, what do you say in this book that is really something that the average Joe would be like, hey, I could really benefit from this?
I think this book is a good overview of perspectives and pathways for flourishing, that there's a lot of things that might have been, you might know, but there's a lot of things that you might not, in terms of methods by which behaviors you could change, thoughts you could change, practices you could change, that would really improve how you're feeling, how you're doing on a day-to-day basis, that is informed by psychiatry, but really looking beyond the frame of mental health, moving towards what really is a full life. And so particularly, I think it's good for those in that weary, languishing, I'm hopeful that it's helpful for my, you know, really depressed patients too, but they're talking to me and they need to see a mental health professional. But in that middle category, maybe you don't need to see a mental health professional, but things aren't great. This is the book for you.
All right. And if folks want to get their hands on the book or even just learn more about you or some of the treatments that you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, where would you like them to go to find that information?
So my personal website, davidcarrion.com, you can find out about me. The book should be available at all major booksellers, including Amazon. If you want to find out about the treatments that I provide, Acacia Clinics, A-C-A-C-I-A, clinics.com is our clinics website. Yeah, feel free to reach out in any of those venues.
Great. Well, Dr. Carrion, it has been amazing having you on here. You are telling me things that I'm definitely going to be checking out because they are things I have not heard before. And I really appreciate what you're doing to help people and your book really focusing us on ways I think that probably any of us can use to try to make our lives more joyful. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for the show today. Again, we've been speaking with Dr. David Carrion about his book, The Opposite of Depression, and about some of the stunning breakthroughs in depression treatment and principles we can use to help overcome some of those depressive thoughts. Again, this is Anthony Barone Kolenc, and you can learn more about me and my books on my website, anthonykolenc.com. Until next time, may God bless us as we rely on our faith to work through the messy challenges of our lives.